This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome. This is Greg Diener, and me and Robert Silva are back for the second part of our series on who we feel are the 10 greatest wrestlers ever in the Place to Be Nation Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever project, and we continue our discussion with Bret the Hitman Hart. Number 8. This was the only guy where we both matched on number 8, and that
is Bret Hitman Hart.
Yes. I mean, let's go to the beginning, because we have him as tag team with Jim Neidhart. And
yeah, but Bret Hart is on that Bruno Sammartino level when it comes to longevity. Where
yeah.
He has such a long, long list of accomplishments and things he did in the WWF. Only probably matched by Bruno and Pedro Morales. Pedro Morales didn't make the top 10 here, but I mean, from the beginning, I remember when Bret Hart first came on WWF television. In the fall of 1984, Greg, there was a show on late nights on WOR. I mean, it might have been midnight. Probably was midnight. They had switched. They had put championship wrestling in the morning, and they had the midnight show was All-Star Wrestling. And All-Star Wrestling in late 1984 was coming out of Ontario. Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. They would do the tapings with Jack Reynolds, who was one of the worst, if not the worst, wrestling announcer of all time.
Don't get me started on Jack Reynolds. He's horrible.
And Angelo Mosca, who was probably the worst color commentator in history of the sport.
Oh.
But he was a white knee babyface, Bret Hart, and he would win his matches against, you know, the so-called jobbers. Then they started putting him in as a mid-card guy, and he would lose. He would lose all the time. And in early 1985, he started to change. His hair became greasier and longer and blacker. He started becoming more aggressive. And then finally, in March of 1985, when Jimmy Hart came in, they formed the Hart Foundation with him and Jim Neidhart, an idea that was Bret's idea. And that's when his career began to take off. In 1985, he had great matches. The Hart Foundation had great matches that would steal the house shows. And anybody went to the WWF house shows back in 1985. It was the shit. But the Hart Foundation versus the Killer Bees, or the Hart Foundation versus the British Bulldogs, would always steal the show.
They were a good team, Bret and Jim, because obviously they were familiar with each other in Stampede. And the matches, Davey Boy and Dynamite, I mean, those four were just magic.
They're four relatives working.
Yeah.
Got two brother-in-laws and two cousins. They're four relatives working every night on the road.
You know, when you're together, like, a long time, you know each other, you know how they work. Obviously, you're going to have, like, the best match on the show every night.
And these guys grew up together in Calgary, and Davey Boy and Dynamite were cousins. Bret Hart and Jim Neidhart were brother-in-laws. And Bret Hart and Dynamite's kid were both married to two sisters. So they were family.
Bret, I think in 86, he was originally in WrestleMania 2, going to wrestle Steamboat, I think. And
instead, they had the match at the Boston Garden. And it's still, in my opinion, this was the greatest match that ever occurred in the history of the Boston Garden. That match, it was only shown in the Boston area. And you get it on videotape later on. When I first saw that match on videotape, when I made a trade 4 or 5 years later, I was like, how the fuck did I miss this? That was a spectacular match against arguably the greatest worker in history of sport, Ricky Steamboat. But Bret Hart wasn't being carried. He was on the level of Steamboat that night. That showed the potential greatness for Bret Hart.
And
was it in 96 also where he had the match with the Mega Man, Tom
McKee? Yes!
And Vince McMahon is in the control booth jerking off. Going, I just, that's my world champion.
Like, yeah, there was a world champion in that match. It just wasn't Tom McGee.
It wasn't Tom McGee.
I know we talked about it before, but Brett was in that battle royal at WrestleMania 2. Him and Jim were the last two with Andre. And it's weird because Brett was the last man in the battle royal at WrestleMania 2.
In 88.
And against right. Bad News Brown.
And that was his turn. That was when him and once again, you go back to the Calgary thing. Him and Bad News Brown, they both came from Calgary. They both wrestled in Calgary. They're the last two guys. And so they make an agreement that they're going to share the prize. And so Bret Hart is doing his, you know, with his arrogant pose. And he gets super kick over the top rope. And so that begins his face turn. He turns face. And his first face turn was before that, though, Greg, before that. The match that showed that he had potential stardom was the November 1987 Saturday Night's Main Event against Randy Macho Man Savage, which was the greatest match in the history of that great program. And it's funny, him and Macho Man had lined up this great match with all these near falls and all these high spots. McMahon comes out and tells Brett and Randy, that's not happening. That's not happening. You're going to do an injured foot angle and you're going to work off that. And Bret Hart was like, but we got this great match. I mean, this might not work. And then McMahon goes, you're a great worker. Figure it out.
Oh.
Wrote his book, which he writes in his book about it. And then they have a great match. I mean, Savage was spectacular with the one leg, and Savage made a great baby face in peril. I mean, that match made Savage even bigger because he's getting ready for his world title reign.
And so Brett, after that Bad News thing, I guess this was like their first. They always wanted to try to make him a singles, but it's like for whatever reason,
it failed.
It never worked.
It failed. He lost. First of all, Bad News Brown was a hot new heel, so it didn't make any sense for him to put Bret Hart over. They're setting him up as a challenger for Randy, which he became a challenger for Randy Savage in the fall and winter of 1988. And then they brought in Barry Windham to feud with him. What was he, the Widowmaker?
Widowmaker.
Oh, that was a horrible concept.
What a terrible gimmick. But before that
program could start, his father and brother go to jail for counterfeiting, and so he takes time off. He doesn't wrestle for a year. And so he stacks. So to the point where they put him back in the tag team with Jim Neidhart because his singles push is going nowhere.
And then Brett and Jim Neidhart, they win the tag belts. Well, we skipped over the first time when they won. Well, Danny Davis, everyone
knows.
Oh,
yes. You got to mention that because that was when for the first time, the WWF did a heel referee gimmick that worked wonders. I mean, the heat Danny Davis got was phenomenal, and it all culminated in the Hart Foundation beating the British Bulldogs for the World Tag Team titles January of 1987.
That was in Tampa at a Superstars or a Challenge Tag.
Right. Was the Sundome?
Sundome,
yep. Yeah.
And that was, I mean, basically they took the belt off because Dynamite at that point, he had the neck injury that derailed the rest of his career. But
he had gotten hurt a month early in a match against Orton in Morocco.
Yeah.
In which he was basically in traction. So they had to drop the belt. So unbeknownst to the crowd, he was led to the ring. He was being carried piggyback style by Davey Boy to the ring because he couldn't even walk. They didn't show that on television. I guess the crowd was. I guess the crowd might have been confused.
Yeah,
they didn't understand what was going on. But they didn't show that on television. I believe that was the same tapings where you're bleeding.
Oh yeah,
you're bleeding with
Hulk and Andre.
Andre turns on Hulk. You're bleeding. You're bleeding.
It's yeah. I actually do think that it was the whole Dynamite thing. Because I've been watching some of the pro wrestling this week from January of 87, and Bill After kind of like brings up. It's like in his. It's like it's so weird because you know, it's like a quasi shoot segment of After like criticizing the WWF for like making Dynamite Kid work so hard, and he has this injury. It's like it's so weird for 1987 standards.
Well, he's also ripping the WWF because at that point in time, After's in a real life feud with the WWF because they won't let him come to ringside to to take photos.
Yeah, because this is at the point where WWF's just like pushing their own magazine at this point.
So right.
So it's like why do we need you know PWI and the Wrestler and all these other mags like when we have our own. Right. Well, going back to the second title reign, which with Brett, the 2 out of 3 falls match they had with Demolition at SummerSlam.
That was the best match Demolition ever had. Was that 2 out of 3 fall match? That was the best match they. I mean, the Brainbuster. Oh, was it SummerSlam?
Which 89.
SummerSlam was it? Where 89. They lost to the Brainbusters. The Hard Fun. That was a great match. Great match.
Yeah, and it was a fun match because I rented the Coliseum video of that in 95, and I actually did not know that the Brainbusters were the tag champs at one point. So
I didn't understand, Greg, was they had that as a non-title match. Makes no sense to me. These are the former world champions going up against the champions.
Well, I think the storyline reason was they booked the match before the Brainbusters won the title.
Right, so it made sense. Right.
But the most amazing thing about watching that match is Tony Schiavone's on play-by-play.
Yes.
So you have like these two guys who you associate with Crockett wrestling a WWF tag team, and you basically have a Crockett announcer. On play-by-play.
And it was a NWA Mid-Atlantic type tag team match.
But, I mean, and even Schiavone says that 89-90, that was like his best year as an announcer. And when you listen to the stuff, yeah, it is like some of his best stuff.
Even though they put him with some, I mean, they teamed him one time with Superstar Graham, but Tony did a tremendous job in the WWF. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Vince was grooming him to be his replacement, but then he turned around and went back to Atlanta.
Yeah, because I think he didn't like living in Connecticut, which so
right. Well, like, the majority of Southern guys had the same complaint. Cornette, Pritchard, they hated living in Connecticut.
The second title run they have, it ends at WrestleMania 7, Bret and Jim with the Nasty Boys, which is a very underrated match. Nobody ever gives the Nasty Boys any credit as like a tag team, but like some of their stuff in 91.
No, that was a good match, and it also had where it's the Hart's former manager is now the Nasty Boys manager. That was I love the storylines how they built this, and I think Bret had a lot to do with his storylines where it would make it more interesting. Okay, look, I'm taking like when you'll be getting to it soon. The brother-in-law versus brother-in-law match, where for the first time they reveal actual relatives in the WWF because they didn't used to do that.
No.
Blackjack Mulligan and Barry Windham wrestled for years. They never said they were father and son. Randy Savage and Lanny Poffo, they never mentioned they were brothers. It wasn't until Bret took on Davey Boy that they brought in the fact that these guys were actually brother-in-laws. It was the first time since the expansion 84 with the WWF, Cowboy Bob Orton and Barry O. They never would mention real-life brothers. Realize father and son as actually being related.
No, they never did. And it's a good storyline too, where Jimmy finally gets his revenge on the Hart Foundation, and
he's
rolling on he's rolling on the ground with the titles. Like, dude,
yes,
like, that always cracks me up every time I watch that. But then this is the true end of him and the Anvil as a team.
That's the end of the Hart Foundation. That's the end of that version of the Hart Foundation.
And then it's the singles run begins, and then it starts. Well, it basically does start at SummerSlam at the Garden against Mr. Perfect, and they have
great match, great match. And I got to give Mr. Perfect credit. He went into that match. He shouldn't have. I think he had a ruptured disc in his back. He had no business wrestling in that match. and he put on what arguably was the best match of his WWF run. That was a tremendous match, and other than the coach being in the match, I have no problem with that match. That was a perfect match.
I would like to, I'd like to retcon John Tolles out of the match and just pretend it never happened. I love at the end of the match where it's like Brett is like ripping the singlet off Mr. Perfect, and you and Roddy in the background's like, tear him up, Brett, tear him up.
And that was a shame because Perfect, because of his injury, couldn't use the juice, and so you saw how flabby he had become.
Yeah. But
and then there was a great scene when the match is over where Lord Alfred Hayes is trying to interview his parents, but
yeah.
Stu was like pushing Lord Alfred Hayes out the way so he could hug his son.
Yo, it's funny you mentioned Stu, because at the Garden, I think it's at that same show, and I know Dave's talked about it on it. You know how he did the 30 WrestleManias for the lap span, where he did like a segment for each WrestleMania. He talks about how at WrestleMania 7, like, because they were holding Cauliflower Alley at Los Angeles, and Stu was going to go to it. But someone at WWF gave Stu the wrong directions, so he never went
God.
To... He didn't go to Cauliflower Alley, and Dave was expecting to see Stu there. So when when Dave meets with Stu again at the Garden, he's like, Stu, where were you? And he said, they just gave me bad directions. And Dave said he never knew who gave Stu the bad directions to Cauliflower Alley.
It might have been his son, Owen.
It could have been. I didn't even think of that.
Because if you remember, Bret Hart's WWE induction speech was spectacular. Hall of Fame speech. He talked about how Owen would call Stu and pretend that he was some. Oh, this is Reggie Parks. You think you're tough. Come on now, Stan. I'm going to kick your ass.
If
he would always pull Price like that.
If you wanted to fight me, you should have fought me.
Yes. You should have told me that back then. Why do you wait till now?
Oh, God. And I've never understood how... So supposedly he relinquishes the title because he wanted to go to WCW, but there was something with his
country. The rumor was that he... But he wasn't going. He had talks with WCW. He had no intention, and Brett never wanted to leave the WWF. He loved the WWF. Anybody read his book could see that he was forced out the WWF back in 97. He was having to go. He just wanted to see what the offer was. He wasn't going to leave, but McMahon punished Brett by having him lose the title to the Mountie, Jacques Rougeau.
Yes, and I think it was a house.
Which in turn helped his career because he had that great match with Roddy Piper at WrestleMania.
Yes, and that match is probably one of my favorite undercard matches in the first 10 WrestleManias. And I love the backstage promo like him and Piper do with Mean Gene, where Piper's
and
like,
you notice a trend with Bret Hart. He's bringing reality into his matches. He's bringing real life reality in his matches that started. Oh, well, we didn't talk about... Oh, yeah, we'll talk about that after this. We'll get to that. But it started with... reality. It might have started with this match. Yeah, this is where he started with the reality of real life, what happened in real life. Stu Hart was a big part of Roddy Piper's beginnings as a pro wrestler, and that was brought into the storyline. Actually, it started with the SummerSlam match against Mr. Perfect. Because Mr. Perfect talked about, my father Larry was a better wrestler than your father Stu. So Bret Hart began to implement that in the building up of his matches. And this was greatly done because Piper always used to consider Bret Hart. And if you read Piper's book, he always considered the Harts as his cousins and Stu as a grandfather / uncle type figure. And they brought that into the storyline.
Yes, and Roddy's talking about, I remember when Mrs. Hart used to bring me all the sandwiches and all the bologna. And of course, you only got one piece of bologna. But it didn't matter because I was hungry. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that was, I think, the only time in Piper's 84 to 92 run that he was ever pinned clean.
No, I think Snuka pinned him clean in a match where Lutez was the referee. It was a Fijian strap match. I have that match on tape. But Piper quickly regained his heat by hanging Snuka with the strap after the match was over. He might have did a job to Rude inside a cage, but not being pinned, Rude might have escaped. They had several cage matches when they were feuding. Okay. The one at the Garden was a tremendous, tremendous match. But that might have been it. He never jobbed to Hogan.
No.
He jobbed to San Martino in the cage, too, where San Martino would escape the cage and beat Piper. So Bret Hart was part of a very short list of wrestlers that Piper put over.
Yeah.
Oh, Piper, I think, did suffer a pinfall to Flair.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
With Flair King.
Yeah, because that
is before it in the fall of 91.
Yes,
he got pinned by. But Flair's one of his best friends, so that's understandable. Yeah.
That is actually there is a match where he is pinned on the release set, DVD set. I just remembered.
It was like four or five wrestlers that because he never dropped to Orndorff, even though it makes sense when Orndorff had that big feud in 85. One of the reasons Orndorff's babyface run was hampered severely was because Piper never did the job to Orndorff. They're one of the biggest feuds in the company at that time. But Piper rarely ever jobbed, and Bret Hart was one of the few guys, and he put Bret Hart over. That made Bret Hart, and he never turned back after that.
Then we go to SummerSlam 92 with Bulldog, and we mentioned the real-life family thing with Diana.
Right.
And that was going to be I think it was originally going to be if the – because the card was, they didn't decide if it was going to be in D.C. or London, so they had two shows planned out where the main event would have been Bret and Shawn for the Intercontinental title, and the other option was Bret and Bulldog at Wembley, and then they got London because the WWE's popularity in the U.K. in 92 was just off the charts. So,
and for a sporting event, that record held until last year.
At the
for England, for Wembley.
Yeah.
Anthony Joshua just Klitschko destroyed that record. But up until last year, that was the biggest paid attendance in Wembley Stadium history for a sporting event until Anthony Joshua versus Vitalik Klitschko last year. I mean, that match had all the heat in the world. It was a babyface versus babyface match. But the personal issues made that match even bigger. And even though, quote-unquote, Ultimate Warrior versus Randy Savage was the main event, it's funny. The two top matches at that card was face versus face matches, which never occurred before in the history of WWF. The match with Davey Boy and
Bret
was a spectacular match where Davey wins the Intercontinental title. It was revealed in Bret's book that Davey was high on crack that day.
Yeah, because isn't there one point in the match where he says where Davey Boy says to Bret he's effed?
Yes.
There's something.
Yes. That shows you how great of a fucking work. If Shawn Michaels is 1A when it comes to greatest workers in the history of the WWE, Bret Hart's 1B. Because who in the hell would take a crackhead, would carry a crackhead through a match and get that type of match out of him? I mean, it's one thing to do a coked up Kerry Von Erich. Ric Flair would carry Kerry Von Erich coked up. But crack's a different animal.
Hell of a drug, man. Hell of a drug. It's an emotional moment, you know, him and Bulldog and Diana and with the fireworks and Bulldog's the national hero in London. I can't say enough about that. But that match
also made Bret Hart a big time draw in England because whenever the WWF would go to England, they would make sure he was on those cards, even if he was on a sabbatical, like when he was doing Lonesome Dove, he would always make those European trips.
Yeah, that match, I think I think he was a made man after that in the WWF. After that match, and then you know, a month and a half later, in his home country of Canada, beats Ric Flair at a house show to become the WWF champion. I remember when he won the title. I was just thinking. Wow, that's amazing. Bret Hart is the champion.
And I started subscribing to The Observer in 1990. And even then, you know, they would always come up with expect this to happen. He had no clue of that. You didn't know about that title change until they appeared. Back then, Superstars of Wrestling would come on at noon on Saturdays, and that's when you found out. I got the Observer 2 hours late in the mail, and then Dave talked about it after the fact. That's one of the few times back then that Dave was kayfabed.
Yeah, because I think the original plan, I think, was Warrior was going to be the champ. And Dave even says about this on The Last Fan about WrestleMania 8, because when he's like, oh, they changed the title. Where? Saskatoon. He's like, why would they give the Warrior the title in Saskatoon? And it's like, no, Brett won the title in Saskatoon.
What happened was, and it also affected Davey Boy, both Davey Boy and Ultimate Warrior had failed steroid tests, and so they were both immediately fired, and so they took they made Brett the world champion, and they took the Intercontinental title off of Davey and had him drop it to Shawn Michaels at the next Saturday night's main event.
And they make Brett out early on in his first title run as like a fighting champion, taking on
all comers,
you know, Papa Shango, the Mountie, Virgil,
a who's who of mid card heels. Yeah.
It's like you realists.
Then he did have a great program with Iron Man matches throughout the United States with Ric Flair.
There's an Iron Man match, I think, that's on a handheld of him and Flair at
I have that. I think it's from the Boston Garden. I have that.
So
I have that on tape.
That should be on an unreleased DVD. That match.
That was a great match. That was a great match. I mean, as much as they're friends now, but back then, until 5 years ago, up until when Flair's son died, they were heated rivals. After Flair's son died, Bret Hart reached out to him, and they've become friends since. They always talk bad about each other in the ring, but they had some great matches. I mean, the match they had at WCW on Sold Out was a tremendous match back in '98, one of the best matches of that year in WCW. And they had some good matches. Those Iron Man matches were real good.
And then the first title run ends with Yokozuna, and then we know what happens.
The only reason that happened was because Vince got Hogan's pen to paper, and he thought he could relive Hulkamania, but Hulkamania was not going to be relived with a guy that had lost 100 pounds.
So then Brett, the next pay per view, King of the Ring, that is probably the Bret Hart show to me.
That was one of the greatest one-man shows in the history of professional wrestling. I mean, every match was a great match with Razor Ramon, Mr. Perfect, and Bam Bam Bigelow. The Mr. Perfect match being the best out of the three. That match was even better than that SummerSlam match.
Yeah, and it's great because you have Perfect. He's babyface, but he's kind of being heelish, and it's bringing back, you know, can Perfect get the win? And it's a good commentary, too, because you have JR with Savage and Bobby. And that is they weren't together that long. But, I mean, it was just for WrestleMania and King of the Ring. But those three were, like, great together. But I think their commentary really made that match, you know, something special. Brett going that final match with Bam Bam, winning with the victory roll, and becoming the first ever on pay-per-view King of the Ring. And then it leads to, without a doubt, probably one of my favorite feuds in the history of the company, the 2-year-long feud with Jerry the King Lawler.
And, you know, Bret Hart is my favorite wrestler ever. He's my all-time favorite wrestler. And up until this, and at this point, he's becoming, he wasn't yet. At this point, it was Snuka and Piper all time. Bret Hart was getting there. When Jerry the King Lawler did what he did to him at the coronation, I'm a hardcore fan. I'm a smart mark. I was pissed. I'm like, I'm fucking king. How the fuck can you do this to my man, Bret Hart?
And then it leads to one of my, and then he calls him the Burger King.
That was great. Yeah. And that feud was Drew Big House's at a time when the WWF was doing bad business at the box office, the Bret Hart Jerry Lawler feud did tremendous business at a time when they weren't doing business. 93 and 94 and 95 were very bad years for the big two. WCW was real horrible. They were drawing like 500 people to the Omni. But the WWF, other than the Garden, wasn't really doing big houses back in 93. But that Bret Hart Jerry Lawler feud did big business until Jerry Lawler got falsely accused of statutory rape, and they had to end it real quick.
Yeah. They have the SummerSlam, which I 93, which I love, where Jerry's on crutches, and he's like, oh, I was in a bad accident on the highway.
Yeah.
That was cool. And then
they do have the match, and he puts him in the sharpshooter, and they reverse the call because he won't let it go. That was great.
And then we get to the stuff of Owen, where they form the tag team. They have the snafu at Survivor Series, and then they get, let's form a tag team. And then Owen kicks the leg out of his leg, and then that goes into WrestleMania after Bret.
Well, they had that great, great opening match. Great, great match. Great match.
Probably the best opening match on a pay-per-view in the history of the WWF. And then Owen gets the victory over Bret.
It was great booking by Pat Patterson, because you have him lose the opening match, then he comes back and he wins the title from Yokozuna. So that naturally sets up that next program, Bret versus his brother, because there's always great booking. I love that booking where the guy that wins the title loses to a good or to somebody right before he wins the title. So you have a natural made a rivalry once you win that title.
Yeah, Neidhart comes back in Bret's corner for King of the Ring against Diesel. And then it sets up him turning and making Owen Hart King of the Ring. And then it goes to the SummerSlam cage match, which a lot of there are some people that rag on that cage match, but
I love that match.
I enjoy it.
I love that match. The only problem I have with this match is the many times they got rammed into the cage, nobody bled. But at that point in time, the WWF wasn't blading. They didn't allow blading. I mean, Bret had to pretend that he bled hard way against Piper 2 years prior to that. So they weren't doing blading back then. But other than the blading, it was a tremendous match. I mean, up and down. Dave gave it 5 stars. I gave it 4.25. I thought it was a great match.
And then the summer of 94, he has some great TV matches. You know, he talked about the match with 1-2-3 Kid on Raw.
That was a great match. And that match, to me, that match made 1-2-3 Kid. Because that match, he was the ultimate underdog. He was getting his ass kicked and back and forth. Bret beats him, but then Bret realizes that it was a mistake by the referee. And so he allows the match to continue to be restarted. And then several times you're thinking, oh my God, 1-2-3 Kid's going to win. When the match is finally over, JR and Randy Savage stand up and give the match a standing ovation. You never saw that before in the history of wrestling with announcers. That was great. I mean, and that wasn't part of the script. That was JR and Randy Savage appreciating two great workers doing a great job. That was tremendous.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was the best match I ever saw. Yeah, that was great.
And then you have the Superstars match with Bob Backlund, where Bob Backlund snaps.
Great angle. Great angle. Yes.
And I love the Mr. Bob Backlund character. It's probably one of my favorite things in mid-90s WWF. And then you go to Survivor Series 94, where they have the submission match, playing off on the December 83 match that Backlund had, saying that he'd never lost the title. It was only
right,
Arnold
right, right.
stolen through the towel in. And then it's Owen, like, forcing poor old Helen to throw the towel
to
in.
But that's my brother! I love him!
And then Owen pulling like the original Survivor Series screw job on Bret, and running off. And he's like, "You're a loser." Just being a giant dick. Just unbelievable. But I mean, 95 is kind of considered it's kind of like, when you think about it, a lost year, because Diesel is the champ for mostly all of it. But he still has some good matches in that 95 with Hakushi.
Well, yeah, the Royal Rumble match was a great match with Diesel. That was a great match. Like I said, Diesel had his best. The only great matches Diesel had while he was in the WWF was with the Shawn or Brett. The I Quit match with Bob Backlund on the WrestleMania, that was boring as hell. And to me, that feud was over already. I don't even know why they went there with that match. But I guess they had to come to a conclusion on that.
It's funny because my pay-per-view carrier, for some reason, like
living in New York. Cablevision went off the air while that match was going on.
Someone who was carrying the feed must have knew the match sucked, and they just did everyone a favor. So thankfully we missed Roddy saying, "What do you say?"
What's it, Bob?
Bob Backlund.
What do you say?
Can't quite set you down the way in.
What do you say?
If he gets Brett down on the canvas, it'll be history.
He doesn't really have it all the way on him yet. He's got to. No.
And look at the reversal.
But during the spring and summer of 95, Bret Hart had some tremendous matches with Pierre Lafitte and Hakushi.
Yeah, Hakushi's like one. I didn't put him on my list, but he's that.
They missed the boat on Hakushi. They should have turned him face. He would have been tremendous. Well, they always do with Japanese wrestlers.
Yeah.
Look how they're mishandling Nakamura today. But they missed the boat on Hakushi. Hakushi was their great Muda. They could have really ran with that.
And then we go to Survivor Series.
Oh, remember the Hakushi came out with the Bret Hart head?
Oh, yes. Yes.
That reminded me of a After magazine cover years ago where Kamala had Hogan's head on a stick in the cover.
Oh, yes. That's awesome. All right. And then Survivor Series 95, where Brett wins the title back. And you have, I think, the first.
That was another great. That was a great, great, great match. Love that match because Bret Hart's the perfect babyface in peril. He gets thrown into the table. They weren't doing that back then in
first
the WWF.
First table spot, I think.
And,
ever.
Yeah, yeah, and then finally he wins with a small package.
And then Diesel just jackknifes him like five times.
Eight turns heel. It began a great heel run for Diesel.
He has the next match next month, Bulldog at In Your House.
Which was a better match in my opinion than the match they had at SummerSlam. That was a phenomenal match where Brett, they began to blade back then. They began to blade again. And Brett is bleeding like a stuck pig.
Yeah, and it was so good that they actually had to put it on free TV because nobody watched it, because nobody bought the pay-per-view, and so
bought that pay-per-view, right, because at that point in time, their business was suffering.
Yeah, so they did it as basically, I think it might have been on the Raw Ball on New Year's 96, where they just did it as a rating stunt against Nitro.
Now, the cage match with Diesel, where Undertaker comes from where his head comes out, was that at Royal Rumble?
That was In Your House 6.
Okay, that was great booking. I love that.
And Diesel goes to hell. We talked about the Iron Man match, which we already talked about with Sean, but. He comes back and he has the feud that makes Stone Cold Steve Austin's career.
Oh, before that, he does. We were mentioning he did the Lonesome Dove TV series.
Yeah.
He takes time off, and then when he comes back, he negotiates with WCW again, and that's when he gets that 25, 30 year lifetime
20-year
contract
deal
for $1 million a year, because the WWF knew if they lost Bret Hart, they'd be in deep shit because they were losing so many stars to WCW at that point. And then that's when he begins to feud with Stone Cold, which the Pillman gun angle was part of that, because Pillman is so, once again, they bring real life into Bret Hart's program. Brian Pillman's a heel, but he's cheering for Bret Hart because they both were in Calgary together, and he's an honorary member of the Hart family. And Stone Cold gets mad, and he breaks Pillman's leg with the chair, and that leads to the gun angle, and then Pillman in real life is all fucked up because his leg is shot. That's so he can go and rehab for 6 months, which leads to the SummerSlam match at Madison Square Garden. Again, it's funny, Greg, how so many of Bret Hart's greatest matches are all at the Garden.
I think they reenact the Mania 8 finish with Piper, where it's, you know, he puts his feet on the ropes and right. Then it leads to the pin. And then Royal Rumble, where it begins this pattern of him getting screwed with Austin winning it.
Even though he should have won because Austin got eliminated, but the referee didn't see it. So Stone Cold wins the title. And then it's supposed to lead up to Shawn versus Bret. But on a very famous episode of Raw, and I don't think it was Monday Night Raw, I think it was a Thursday Night Raw, Shawn Michaels comes out and he tells the world that he lost his smile. That his knee is to the point where he can no longer wrestle, and that he has to abdicate the crown, and he gives the title to McMahon. Also, he wouldn't have to job to Bret Hart at the next WrestleMania, because that was the plan. He was to lose the title to Bret Hart. So he gave it up, and you had a great match in your house where you had the Fatal Four, the Final Four.
Final Four.
You had the great match with Undertaker, Vader, Stone Cold, and Bret Hart.
Yes. And I guess we can use that to segue. I mean, we'll segue into Austin because he was my number seven, so we'll talk about him next. But we have to get Montreal out of the way just so to finish on Bret. So that.
Oh, but you got the entire Hart Foundation angle,
yeah.
Which is the single greatest angle that I've loved. My favorite single greatest angle in the history of professional wrestling was when he, after the spectacular I Quit match. In the history of professional wrestling, there are only two I Quit matches to talk about. It's the Magnum T.A. Tully Blanchard Starrcade I Quit match and the Bret Hart Stone Cold Steve Austin WrestleMania I Quit match. Both those matches are the two, not only the two greatest I Quit matches in the history of sport, they're two of the most historically significant matches because they made careers. It made Magnum T.A. into a superstar, and it made Stone Cold Austin into a superstar.
Incredible match.
And that's my favorite match of all time. I love this match. I could watch this match all day. This match looked like a real-life brawl. I mean, they beat the shit out of each other. And Stone Cold, to this day, always talks about his best opponent was Bret Hart. Bret Hart loved Stone Cold. I mean, they had chemistry in the ring. I don't think in either of their careers they had a better opponent. These two were made for each other.
You know, Montreal, I mean, that thing, it was just going to come into a head. Bret and Shawn, they were like they were like oil and water. It was like,
right,
it was
right,
just
right.
One of them eventually at some point was going to have to go. They had that fight backstage in the summer, and it was all.
Oh, yeah, Bret fucked him up. Bret put his head into a toilet.
Yeah. And he took his hair out, and Jim Cornette got some of the hair. He told that story like he actually took the hair pulled from Shawn's head. And he,
yeah, it's part of Cornette's collectibles.
Yes.
But up there, that heel run where he was a babyface in the rest of the world, and the heel in the United States was so creatively done. And that was all Bret. That was all Bret. And Bret was never a great promo. He was a phenomenal promo in 97 because he believed this shit. He's like, oh, you guys cheer OJ. The stuff that goes on, the race relations in this country. Oh, he was just great. Just great. And the way he formed the Hart Foundation together, where he forgave his brother-in-law Davey and his brother Owen, and Owen's crying, "I love you, Brett." It was just great. It was just great television. Raw was. I taped Nitro just so I could watch Raw back then because I didn't want to miss any of this. It was just great television where Stone Cold was about to kick him off the ring, and then they called and they tossed Stone Cold off the ramp. Great television, week in and week out.
Yeah, that 97 Raw is some of the best television they've ever done. Like, I don't think anything compares to that. Everyone like goes to like the Russo stuff later on, 98, 99.
No, but see, this set it up.
It
this
did.
This set up the Attitude Era. There would be no Attitude Era if Stone Cold and Bret do not have that classic match at WrestleMania. If they don't turn Bret heel and start the Hart Foundation, that all set up the Attitude Era. Because after Bret left, the first time McMahon ever got to the Stone Cold Stunner was doing the 9/11 MSG Raw in 97. That was all during that time period.
Go to the Survivor Series match. It's not spectacular.
Oh, it was a great matchup until the screw job.
Yeah.
It was becoming to be a it was on the way to being a classic until the screw job happened. That was a heated match. The heat in the building was ridiculous. It was a tremendous brawl. It wasn't the usual Bret Shawn Michaels match of high spot. It was an all out fight. It was a tremendous match.
Yeah, and
up until the screw job finish.
If it doesn't end abruptly, I'm sure it would be
It would have been a five-star class.
It would have.
Without a doubt. It would have been the best match they ever had against each other.
And it's weird now today when you think, if you have like a 15-year-old that's watching it and you tell them the story about the backstage stuff about how Bret didn't want to lose the belt, they'd be like, well, what's the big deal with that? But, there was a wrestling war going on between WCW and WWF. It would have been embarrassing for the WWF to have their world champion on Nitro. Even though, you know.
Yeah, but WCW couldn't have done it because there was already a court injunction and they would have paid a huge penalty. It wouldn't have been worth it. The risk would have been worth it.
I mean, he comes back with the Hall of Fame and then he comes back in 2010 as the GM. Not as the GM. The feud with Vince.
No, he has that feud with McMahon that was.
Oh, it was terrible.
He couldn't work anymore.
No.
He couldn't work. It didn't. He couldn't work. He after the stroke, he was never the same. So physically, he could work. And that match at WrestleMania, that might have been the single worst match in the history of WrestleMania. The McMahon versus Bret Hart match, where Bret Hart's acting like the heel and McMahon's the face because he's getting beat down for eternity. Let's go to Stone Cold, baby.
Yeah, Stone Cold. It's
and we could take off from WrestleMania where he doesn't quit. He blanks out. Shamrock stops the match, and that is the beginning of the Stone Cold era.
The bloody face launches an era for the next 4 years of WWE,
which is their most profitable era in the history of the promotion.
Yeah, but before that, the year prior. He comes in as the million-dollar
champ. That was a horrible gimmick.
It was terrible.
A horrible gimmick.
And then they let him pick a new name. But it's like they let him pick a new gimmick.
His wife picked it.
Yeah. But the names they pick, they tried to give him, were some of the stupidest names I've ever heard in my life. Otto von Ruthless.
Look, when McMahon signed Austin, he didn't know what he was getting. He didn't know what to do with him. It was an accident what happened, and I believe it was the Jake Roberts feud that created the character Stone Cold, and that's where it began to take off.
Yeah, King of the Ring, where he has at King of the Ring a great match with Mark Mero, which is the one where his lip gets busted up, and so he has to get stitches for that. Comes back for the match with Jake, wins that, and then he delivers the famous. You know, promo, and people think, that launched him. No, it didn't. For a while.
No, because he was still mid-level. It wasn't until the WrestleMania match that he became that the next, that the Stone Cold era began.
Yes.
Because right then and there, McMahon saw. And I think that's when McMahon decided, yeah, I'm going to build the company around Stone Cold.
Then we talked about the Austin feud with the Hart Foundation. It was
which climaxed with that great Calgary Stampede pay-per-view, with that great 10-man match.
Yeah, and Austin's just, you know, he's reveling in being just the bad guy in that. It's like the heat he gets from that crowd is some of the best heat I think I've ever seen.
That was Rock and Roll Express getting beat down in Louisiana in 1984. Where the crowd wants to rush the stage and get at the heel. They wanted to get at Stone Cold that day.
Then it almost comes crashing down at SummerSlam with Owen, where he takes...
He gets his neck broken.
Yeah. And then I don't know how they found a way to finish that match, but they did.
I think it was instinct. I think Stone Cold did that on instinct. If you watch the match over and over again, I mean, he kind of knows where he is. Kind of.
But it's like the most embarrassing. I mean, it's such an embarrassing ending. It's like he just the weakest roll up. But I mean, they had to do that because how do you end it? It's just
you can't have Owen go over because the plan was for Stone Cold to go over.
No, so it's like it just messes everything up. That's like a confusing situation when you're like, what are you gonna do in that spot? And then of course after that we have Austin stunning McMahon for the first time. Drops
the 9/11 1997 MSG Raw.
Wins the belt back from Owen at Survivor Series. And then he has a feud with Brock we talked about. And then goes in, he wins the Rumble.
Mike Tyson angle.
The Mike Tyson angle, which is, I think, the...
That's the turning point in the war. You're
that
right.
Turns... And then that the encounter they have on the San Jose Raw, I think, where it's like
yes.
Him and Austin... Tyson and Austin.
And it's funny, right? Tyson goes in there. He wants to tell Stone Cold how much he admires him, how much of a fan he is. And Stone Cold's like, you're fat. I don't give a damn about your fancy ass. You might be tired.
And then the best
Stone Cold's the heel in that exchange. Mike Tyson's not looking. Mike Tyson's like, I'm in front of Stone Cold. I admire you.
And then the best is Vince yelling at Austin, "You ruined it! You ruined it!
You ruined it! You ruined it!"
Then Austin becomes the champion at the WrestleMania in Boston. Tyson raises his arm, turns on DX, and that is WrestleMania 1. You had Hogan and Mr. T. That was like,
that's like the two most important WrestleManias. In the history of WWE, is the first WrestleMania and WrestleMania 14.
You have the two biggest icons in pop culture at that time.
At that time,
giving
right.
their endorsement to this guy, and that's the moment where Austin just he became a household name after that. It's like everyone knew who Stone Cold Steve Austin was.
And that began the weekly war between Austin and McMahon. You know, he comes out the following Raw, and McMahon wants to be the corporate champion, and then he rips off the clothes, and he gives the stunner to McMahon, and that begins the greatest feud in WWF history, Austin versus McMahon.
The best weekly drama each week was seeing what's going to happen next between these two.
And they would always find a way, Greg, to top it. I mean, you had the gun angle where he kidnaps McMahon, and he takes out the cut, and it goes bang, the word bang. I mean, week after week, oh, my God, where he goes to McMahon's hospital bed and beats him up. It was just great.
Each week, you were just thinking, what's going to happen? What's going to happen next between these two? And something like even crazier would happen. I would not stop. When they were on the TV, it's like, I'm not going to switch channels. I'm just going to stay here and watch this. Because they were so good together. It was just magic to watch those
That's
two.
Why many people consider Vince McMahon, the greatest heel in the history of WWF, WWE, Triple WF, and all because of the way he had chemistry with Stone Cold. That chemistry was unbelievable.
And then we have SummerSlam against that year against Taker. They have at the Garden at 98. And
right.
You have all the shenanigans where he loses the belt in that triple threat match with Taker and Kane. And then it leads to the pro. Well, he gets screwed out of the title at Survivor Series when
right.
Shane screws him right. over. And
right.
then you have like the great stuff at the Royal Rumble where Stone Cold's number one and Vince is number two.
And that's the one that Vince wins.
Yes, the Vince wins. But the best part of that whole feud, that whole thing leading up to the Rumble, is those Vince segments with Shane where he's training like each week, where it's like when they do the Rocky II thing with the chicken in the snow. Shane's basically Mickey. He's like, come on, Dad, you gotta get speed. You gotta get speed. Come on, Dad, number two. And he's like, number two, number two.
And at this point in time, The Rock is the champion because he had gotten it through that Survivor Series screw job.
Yeah.
And that's leading to the WrestleMania, which was huge, huge business, the WrestleMania between Rock and Austin, WrestleMania 15 in 1999.
Yeah. And then the title get – then he wins the belt back at Mania. There's – he trades – there's some weird stuff where he's facing Vince and Shane for control of the company. And there's – oh, because I think he become – wasn't this during the higher power angle? Because I get confused in this period.
No. This is right before – he feuds with Vince and Shane get – what's his name? Mick Foley to be their foil. And Mick Foley turns and starts feuding with Austin through the spring of 99. And then – you don't see Austin McMahon for a while because now McMahon is a quasi babyface as his daughter gets kidnapped by The Undertaker. And so now the higher power is fighting Vince McMahon. What they were trying to do was, it was supposed to be Jake Roberts that was supposed to be the higher power.
Yeah.
But he was still on crack. So instead of bringing back Jake Roberts, horrible booking. Now, Vince McMahon's the higher power. This didn't make no damn sense. It didn't because your daughter got kidnapped by the guy you're fighting.
It didn't make any sense, but at least to one of the great moments of all time where he pulls the hood and JR just says, ah, son of a bitch. That's like the only good thing that comes out of that is son of a bitch.
Now, when does... I'm a bit hazy about when is it when he gets when Austin gets crucified by Undertaker.
That has to be I think it's 98, right?
I believe it's 98. Yeah, and that was great because Jay was like, "Oh, that son of a bitch!"
and doesn't Undertaker try to embalm him?
Yes.
That is like some of the most messed up thing I ever seen. Like they're gonna embalm a human being live on television. I'm trying to think when does his neck become like a problem?
At the tail end of 99, where they do the angle where he gets hit by a car.
That's
so,
right.
So, right? The tail end of 99. Is when the neck becomes a problem, and then they have to turn the reins over to The Rock, and then he comes back in late 2000. You know, he beats up Rikishi because they make this horrible angle that it was Rikishi who was responsible. So he beats up Rikishi, beats him in a steel cage match, and then one of the greatest matches in the history of Monday Night Raw, January 2001, Stone Cold against Kurt Angle. They had a phenomenal match. A great, great match. It ends with the return of Triple H, who hits Austin with the sledgehammer and gives him the fuck was his finishing maneuver? What was Triple H's finishing maneuver?
Pedigree.
The pedigree on the table, and he rips his shirt off, he stands over, and JR is, God damn you! Straight to hell, Triple H! Austin's dream has been ruined! Great. And that began the Triple H Austin feud, which climaxed with the What do they call that match?
Three Stages of Hell.
The Three Stages of Hell, which to this day I do not understand why Austin put Triple H over. It didn't make any sense. Austin was getting shot at the title at WrestleMania, not Triple H.
I guess the logic was that eventually when Austin turned heel that like they were gonna eventually Hunter was gonna be babyface and they were gonna have like another match.
But Hunter was never a good babyface. He's a horrible babyface. He's a jerk off babyface. He's meant to be a heel. It wouldn't have made no sense. And I agree with you. That's probably what it was. And look, Austin wanted to be a heel again. It didn't make any sense. Austin should never have been a heel again. Austin is a babyface. It's like you can't turn him heel. And when they do turn him heel in that great match against The Rock at WrestleMania, they didn't want it. And you turn him a heel in his hometown. He grew up right outside Houston, Texas. It's in the Astrodome, and they turn him heel in his hometown. That makes no sense.
It's like when they did that whole thing where they made Captain America a Hydra agent. It's like nobody buys it. Nobody buys
that shit. No. It doesn't make any sense. And so the WWF, who came off a record year in 2000, profit-wise, which they've never matched since, 2001, they barely make money because the first 4 months is spectacular, but the XFL was a failure, hint, hint, and the invasion angle was a failure. And so they barely were even in 2001.
But even though the heel turn made no money, it gave us some great comedy.
And there was great. And Austin in 2001 might have been his best in the ring. He had great match. There was a great match with him and Triple H against Jericho, and we can't talk about him. He had a great match with great matches all throughout the summer with Angle into the fall with Kurt Angle. The pay per view where they had the final four. Once again, they do the final four for the title, in which Jericho wins it all. That was a great paper.
Yeah,
where Jericho becomes the first undisputed world champion.
Jericho beats The Rock and Stone Cold in one night to be the champion. And it'll always say it. Whenever Jericho comes back, it'll always come up. First undisputed.
But then Triple H tried to bury Jericho so many times back then. First. When Jericho first arrives and he beats Triple H for the Intercontinental title, and they go, "Oh, that match doesn't count; it was not title." And then he loses to Triple H at that WrestleMania in 2002, where that was the main event. But the real main event was The Rock versus Hulk Hogan, which we forgot to talk about. We could talk about when we do Hogan.
We'll talk about that. Well, we got a long ways to go, but that period with Austin is where he leaves the company. I think he has the discipline.
Well, he beats his wife. He beats his wife.
Which is not cool now, especially wasn't cool in 2002.
Well, look, he was taken off television because he beat his wife, the former Deborah McMichael. And then he leaves the company. There was two things that happened. He refused to job to Brock Lesnar, which I agree with, because they're going to put it on Raw. If you're going to job to Brock Lesnar, do it like Rock did. Do it on a pay-per-view. Don't do it on a Monday Night Raw. There's no money in it. And he beat his wife around the same time. So that's when he was forced to leave the WWF for about a year.
Yeah. And then he comes back when Bischoff brings him back in 03. And then he has his last match with Rock at WrestleMania.
They do a thing where The Rock is a heel, and the fans didn't want The Rock to be a heel. But those promos back and forth between The Rock and Stone Cold was spectacular. I mean, there was one where The Rock comes back, and he's in I think it was the Raw in Toronto, And he's like, he's shitting on fans for booing him the year prior in his match against Hogan. And he's like, and they say, Hogan. He said, y'all can see that all y'all want to. He's nowhere near the building. And then he starts ripping on Austin. And Austin comes out in the crowd. He's like, oh, there goes Stone Cold out there selling $5 bootleg T-shirts of his T-shirt.
It's a good capper to end their trilogy with Rock at
with Rock finally going over, because Rock never went over until that final match.
Yes.
I got to give Stone Cold credit. He put Rock over in what would be his final match, and I got to give Stone Cold credit. He's been offered millions of dollars to come back over and over again, and he refuses to do it because he doesn't want to embarrass himself.
No, and I give him a lot of credit for he went out the way he wanted to go out. And that's fine. That's fine by me. And it wasn't a long run. I mean, in the grand scope of things, compared to other guys like Hogan and Cena and Bruno, it's not a long run at the top. Which is
Bret Hart. It's not a long. It basically is 96 to 2003, with a couple years in between where he didn't do anything.
Yeah, but for what he did, it was phenomenal. It was just a phenomenal run he had, and I can't imagine where the company would be if he wasn't there. So
there are three wrestlers in the history of the promotion that deserve lifetime stock. That's Bruno, that's Hogan, that's Austin. Because without those three, there'd be no WWE today. Because each time those guys stepped in, they carried an organization on their shoulders, made millions for the McMahons, and kept them afloat and kept them going. And they'll be ongoing forever because of those three men.
Yes. So now we'll get into your number seven, which was my number five, and that would be the Macho Man Randy Savage.
Macho Man Randy Savage was an unbelievable worker, an unbelievable promo, unbelievable star. He had charisma, and he was just as good a heel as he was a face. One of the few wrestlers in the history of the business that was equally effective both ways. Austin was a great heel, but he was a better babyface. When we went back to heel, it didn't work. Hogan was a great heel in WCW, but it got to a point where it was played out. Savage did both great. He was phenomenal as both. And when he first came into the territory in June of 1985, I remember this vividly. Jimmy Snuka had just gotten fired, and I always felt that Macho Man Savage was Jimmy Superfly Snuka's replacement, because Snuka got fired and Randy Savage got hired the same week in June of 1985.
And he comes in, and there's this big search of who's going to be the Macho Man's manager. Like, who's it going to be? And you have everyone vying for his services, and then he's like, he goes to each of the candidates like, oh, Bobby Heenan, some of the stuff you said, oh, that really freaked me out. Like, stuff. Like,
yes,
he goes to
that.
each of them thanking him. But he's like, he's found his manager. And he's like, everybody look at that curtain. And then it's Miss Elizabeth making her debut. And Vince and Bruno... Vince is like, oh my goodness. And Bruno's like, is that some movie star? What is
that? That was great. That was the single greatest comment Bruno ever made as a wrestling announcer. Is she some type of movie star? That was great.
And then the two of them were magic together. Just whenever you think of the Macho Man, it's like you automatically think of Liz.
Yes, they were permanently intertwined.
Macho, he wins the title from the Intercontinental Belt from Steamboat, and then he has this 1 year run of him being.
Oh no, no, he beat. You mean he beat Santana?
What did I say?
You said Steamboat.
Oh yeah, right. It was Santana, which he beats him with a roll of quarters, and
real quick, I want to real quickly. Tito Santana had a phenomenal run in the WWF that no one talks about. He made my top 25. Go ahead, continue.
Okay, and he becomes the number one heel with Hogan as the number one face. And they, and I've been listening to the Place to Be Nation podcast where they have the MSG house show run where it's...
And I love that podcast. Shout out to Justin and Scott. They do a phenomenal... That's one of the best podcasts, wrestling podcasts out there today. Love that podcast because it's all reminiscent for me because the two shows with the Hockey Talk Man versus Ricky Steamboat, I was at both those shows. Those were two great house shows, and they relive it perfectly. I love that show. And, yeah, Savage was the star at many of those MSG shows because he would bring to life a dead crowd. And those matches, I went to two of those matches with Hogan at the Garden, and those were great matches.
Yeah, and, you know, if you wanted to do maybe a brief run with Savage as the heel champ and then do like a transitional thing back to Hogan, you could have realistically done that, but
it wouldn't have made sense.
It wouldn't have made sense.
Back then, Hogan, they were going, Junior was following Senior's tried and true formula of having a long time babyface champion who would overcome all odds to save the day. It worked with Bruno. It worked with Backlund to a point so people got tired of him. And it was working with Hogan. When they finally did take the title off of Hogan, it was at the right time. And who was the right guy to take his place? The Macho Man.
Yeah. And, of course, the Intercontinental run. He has the program with Steamboat, which you can never say enough good things about.
Probably. That was probably the single greatest IC title feud of all time.
You know, the crushed larynx. It's unbelievable, that feud. And then you have, and I didn't even know this until they, Justin and Scott brought it up on the lead up to WrestleMania 3. I think, don't they have like a match at Maple Leaf Gardens from,
I saw that match a year ago.
Okay.
That was a great, great match where he bloody savages bleeding like a stuck pig, and Savage wins by hook and crook. That was a great match. Great, great match. I believe it was either January or February of 87, before WrestleMania.
And then you go to WrestleMania 3, and they have the match that steals the show. It was probably, I think in that era, if you think about wrestling starting in 1984, not counting NWA, that was probably the first WWF match where you consider, oh, that was an amazing match.
The WWF Universe, that was the first classic.
Yes. And that was...
If you start in 1984, you're right.
If you consider the WWF kin starting in the Hulkamania era in 84, that is the first match you could say, oh, that is without a doubt a classic. So many pinfalls. It's like, I don't think you saw a match like that in WWF where you think, this is the end right here. No, it's not the end. Oh, they're going to keep fighting. Oh, here's another.
And I love Ricky Steamboat when he did the Observer Live many, many years ago. When they used to have the IATA show, when Dave and Brian had the IATA show. He talked about how they were traveling on a plane they were doing their run, their house show run, and that they would go over the WrestleMania match every day, and they would say, okay, move one, cross body box, move two, shoulder blade. But they would go and they would practice over and over again verbatim what the match would be. So by that night, they already had it in their head that they would go have a classic.
That was the first instinct where you thought this guy could be, when given the chance, he could be the man in the company. With that WrestleMania 3 match. And then you mentioned that one rematch I think we had with Steamboat in May.
I was going to school in New Orleans at the time. I didn't come home till a week later. Had I been in New York at that time, I would have went to see that match. Because all I hear is it's a spectacular match. I mean, cage match where they're bleeding buckets. God, these two, it's got to be a classic.
Then we get to the feud with Honky Tonk Man, which is a great, great feud. Because they have
that great match in the Garden, which I didn't get to see because I had gone back to New Orleans. I saw the July and August Honky Tonk Man Steamboat matches. The September 87 match, which Justin and Scott recently reviewed, I was back in New Orleans. That match was right before the Saturday main event match, which they talked about recently, which was a tremendous match where Savage turns face, full-fledged face.
It's that official. It's like him and Hogan. They have like the official like endorsement with the handshake, and it's
right.
And it's like it's one of those great. And I love it because it's Vince and Bobby doing the commentary on it, and Vince is like, "We've just seen a magical moment in sports," and Bobby's like, "I don't know what history books you've been reading, McMahon, because this means absolutely nothing to me." Like it's like
then you have. Then he has the aforementioned match against Bret Hart at the next Saturday main event, which he wins. Elizabeth takes his boot off, and he wins with a small package. And then Honky Tonk Man refuses to job to him at the big event.
The main event
on live network television, the first live network television match in 30 years. On network television, he refuses the job, so he wins by DQ over Honky Tonk Man. So they changed the plan. The original plan was for DiBiase to win the world title because Honky Tonk Man refuses the job to Savage, so Savage can become Intercontinental Champion again. McMahon decides to put it on Savage and have a year-long program where they would tease the match that began one of their biggest pay-per-views of all time, WrestleMania 5, Hogan versus Savage.
Yeah, and Savage wins the title at Mania 4 with winning four matches, which...
It was a horrible pay-per-view.
It was
that
terrible.
Pay-per-view, it was terrible. I saw that pay-per-view at Madison Square Garden on closed circuit, and I took my brother to see it, and we loved the fact that Savage had won. We were jumping up and down. But it was a horrible tournament. And you had a lot of talent in that tournament. You had Don Morocco. You had Hacksaw Butch, the Natural Butch Reed, Valentine, Steamboat, Savage, DiBiase. Some of the best workers of the era. And there was not one good match on that card.
No. And I think, weren't they thinking about doing a Savage Steamboat rematch at that pay-per-view?
Yeah, but then instead they had Steamboat job to Valentine. Had he beat Valentine, his next opponent would have been Savage.
Yeah, maybe that would have made that a much better show, but
yeah.
But I mean, you get the happy ending with Savage being the champ, and then you go into the summer, and Savage just takes the ball and he runs with it as the babyface.
Well, he had the great feud with DiBiase, and I was at that cage match at the Garden in June of 88. Tremendous cage match. I mean, and Virgil was spectacular in that match as constantly interfering and Savage trying to climb over the ropes, and they make a great point on commentary. Well, you know what? There's nothing Elizabeth could do. I mean, she's a woman. Virgil's this muscular manager. I mean, he's caught up in – Virgil was great. Finally, Savage wins the cage match, and you have a fan who got tired of Virgil interfering trying to climb the cage.
I bet Virgil took him for Olive Garden after the show and gave him some breadsticks.
I probably did. Probably did.
And so, and then SummerSlam, you have the great angle with Hogan coming back and them being a tag team as the Mega Powers against the Mega Bucks of Andre and DiBiase.
Right, and DiBiase, right.
Yeah, and you have Jesse as the guest referee for that match. And you have the tag match, and it's like you have all these four. You have these four main personalities in this one match, and then you have one of the most unbelievable moments where Liz takes her skirt off in the middle.
Once again, see, what I loved about WWF back then, the way Pat Patterson booked back then, is that whenever he did something, it had never been done in the WWF before. You had the heel referee, Danny Davis, that had never been done before in the WWF. You had the twin referees, the Hebners, how Hogan lost the title. That had never been done in WWF before. It might have been done in other territories. It wasn't done in WWF before. And Elizabeth taking a skirt off to distract the heels. That had never been done in the WWE.
And the most amazing thing is, DiBiase and Andre are looking at Jesse. He's like, do something. And Jesse's like, I don't know what to do.
What to do?
It's like, I don't, what am I supposed to do? Tell her not to take her skirt off? And then you have Hogan and Savage, you have that one shot where they're like, yes, the plan totally worked. And then it helps lead into that whole Mega Powers feud. And then you go into the main event, the second main event, with them in the Twin Towers, where it all comes to a head on live TV.
That backstage angle where he throws Elizabeth like a dart, I mean, that was, oh my God. And his anger is like, oh my God. And Macho Man was real, you know, in this angle, he's jealous. He's jealous of Hogan because he thinks Hogan is trying to hit on his woman. That was Savage in real life. If you read Ric Flair's book and Bret Hart's book,
he was
Savage
paranoid.
Didn't allow Elizabeth. Yeah, he was very paranoid that Elizabeth would cheat on him. He was always around her, surrounding her, checking up on her. So they took real life and they multiplied it. I mean, oh my God. And he like Hogan. He destroys Hogan in the back. He destroys Beefcake.
Macho.
Greatest heel turn in the history of the promotion.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt at all. And then we go into WrestleMania. They have the match there. And it's a very good match between Hogan and...
Very underrated match. Savage... Oh, one thing we failed to mention. Savage was a huge draw as world champion. He didn't do Hogan money, but he came close. He was as close to Hogan as possible. He had a great run for that 1 year as a drawing world champion. They didn't do that back then. They didn't change it on the fly. But had they decided to change it on the fly and made Savage somehow go over Hogan at WrestleMania, continue the feud, they would have made more money.
Oh, definitely would have. Then you go into, what is it, when Sherry comes and becomes his manager.
And they have a great run. And Sherry was the single greatest female manager in the history of sports. Not even close.
Okay, so at this point we're going to take a little break and we'll resume the rest of me and Robert's discussion on Randy Savage and end the second part in just a bit.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following... Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on three great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
So I abruptly stopped at Randy in the middle of his heel turn. He now is with Sensational Sherry, and they form probably a great heel combination.
She's like the female version of Macho Man Savage. She is just a tremendous bumper, a tremendous worker, tremendous talker, tremendous heel. She's like the opposite of Elizabeth. Elizabeth is portrayed as this sweet, innocent woman, while Sherry is this bombastic, crazy.
She's like the Wicked Witch.
It's the Good Witch. It's the Good Witch versus the Wicked Witch from the Wizard of Oz.
Then Macho Man becomes the Macho King. Takes the king.
Yeah, he beat from Hacksaw Duggan. Yeah.
Yes, he takes the title from Hacksaw. He is now the king. You have the proclamation where it's like all the heels are in the same ring as Savage, and it's like one of the most awesome pictures you'll ever see.
The coronation of the king and the queen. Yeah.
Yes. Macho Man was a great character, but you add him as a king to the mix.
And he had the scepter that he always used.
And you know what's amazing? I didn't even think about it until someone brought it up. When he was in Memphis, he would always try to feud with Jerry Lawler for many years.
He always feuded with Jerry Lawler. Memphis, his biggest feud was Lawler. I mean, he feuded with Rude. Where Rude was a quasi babyface, but that didn't work. His feuds with Lawler were incredible. Man, when he left Memphis to come to the WWF, he had lost an incredible Loser Leaves Town match to Jerry Lawler.
Yeah. But him as the king, that just made him just more over the top than usual. And it was just so amazing to see him and Sherry just. And you bought it. You bought that they were the evil royalty in the WWF. And, cannot say enough good things about that gimmick. And then, in the spring, he's feuding with the American Dream Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah, it was Sapphire and Dusty against Savage and Sherry.
Yes. And there's the one moment from that match that I love where, like, Fink introduces Dusty and Sapphire as like weighing 468 pounds, and then or some ridiculous. And Jesse's like, "Now wait a minute, Gorilla. They said 468 pounds. You're gonna tell me that Rhodes only weighs 200? Because I know damn sure Sapphire weighs about 2.5." And Elizabeth appears that match as the crown jewel for Dusty and Sapphire.
Right.
And then you go into SummerSlam, Savage beats Dusty, and then you have the whole thing with Ted DiBiase and Sapphire, where Ted DiBiase buys Sapphire. I think Survivor Series 90, he's not on the show, I think. I think he might be in an interview segment with Gene.
Yeah, I didn't understand that.
You have, I think, the lead up to Royal Rumble, where he wants a shot at the title. And then you have Sherry, like, on her knees, begging Warrior for the title shot.
I attended a match right before Ultimate Warrior lost the title to Sergeant Slaughter. In January at MSG, they had a match, Savage and Warrior, where he strips Sherry down to her underwear.
Oh, my God.
And then he press slams her. Sherry took a beating in the ring. She was a true sport.
Well, she was always a champ. She could take a beating with the guys better than any man, let me tell you.
Exactly.
Royal Rumble, Savage cost Warrior the title with the scepter, and Slaughter wins the belt. And I love how after Slaughter wins, like, Gorilla and Piper, they're in such denial that Sergeant Slaughter has won the match. It's like, oh no, there's gonna be like a DQ. Like, oh no.
It's gotta be reversed. Yeah, it's not happening.
Yeah, and they're like, oh, this is disgusting. They're like so disgusted that Sergeant Slaughter has won the title. You go to WrestleMania and you have the career-ending match between Warrior and Savage, where the original plan, I guess, was Savage wanted to have a child with Elizabeth, which is why he retired.
Is that why?
Yeah, I believe that's the original reason why he retired.
Yeah, you might be right, because they never had children together.
No, so I guess he wanted to get.
And I don't think Savage ever had children.
No.
Period.
So no.
Yeah.
I think he wanted to get off the road and have a kid, but it didn't work out that way. But the match with Warrior. Yeah, him and Warrior had amazing matches together. Like, the best
they
matches
had two,
of his
They
career.
Had two of the best matches of the in the WWF Universe of that time period. That WrestleMania match and the following year SummerSlam match were tremendous matches.
It's this emotional battle where, you know, Savage is coming in the match on his traditional, what do you call it, that thing the jobbers would carry him on. He's carried to the ring by the bunch of jobbers with that on that podium.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forgot what you call that. Oh, no. God, I forgot. You're right. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then you have Warrior coming in, and he's not even bothering to run. He's taking his time, and Heenan goes, well, why isn't he running? And Gorilla, making a lot of sense, goes, well, this is his career. He's not going to.
He treats it real serious, like, yes.
And it's this great match, and then there's this one point where Warrior looks at his hands, like, and he's considering just walking out. It's like, do the gods want me to not do this anymore? Like, and then Savage does the, like, five elbows, like, he wants to make sure he's absolutely done. Just, that's it. No more. But he kicks out, and I like how it just ends. Like, it's Warrior with his foot on Savage, and it just ends. Like, Heenan is saying, well, one stays, and then the pin happens, and the girl's like, it's over! And Bobby's like, oh my god, no! And then you have the emotional reunion between Savage and Liz, where Sherry beats the crap out of him. Liz comes running out of the crowd, and then the hug, and it's like everybody, I think even grown men, building were crying.
It was WWF soap opera at its finest hour.
And the best part is, Liz always held the ropes for Savage. No, this time he's gonna hold the ropes for her. And then he walks out, and that's the end of the Macho King. He's now the Macho Man again. And then he goes to the announce booth for a little while, and then that's when we have Jake Roberts and their feud.
The lead up to this was incredible. Jake Roberts throughout the summer was doing vignettes with Ultimate Warrior, where come into my space lair, in which he turns on the Ultimate Warrior and teams up with the Undertaker, and that was just great television. And then finally, Jake Roberts originally was supposed to be on SummerSlam to take on Earthquake to end their feud, but that match was quickly scrapped because they were going to turn Jake. So Jake didn't wrestle. He shows up at the reception, because Macho Man and Elizabeth got married during SummerSlam, and the reception was great because it was the introduction of Sid Justice as a babyface, and they give Elizabeth a gift, and a snake comes out.
Like, ah, it's a snake! And it just freaks the hell out of everyone. Everyone's just running out of the place. And then, for some reason, Sid shows up.
Yeah, and he wards off Undertaker and Jake with a chair while Elizabeth and Macho Man are crying.
And so so this leads into Savage wanting to get reinstated, and one of the most... angles that I think horrified a lot of kids back in 1991.
You saw children at ringside were crying, were in fear, when the snake was gnawing on Macho Man's arm. What an angle!
And then, the best part is, Piper just runs out. He's like, I can't take this anymore! He runs out, and and then Vince is like, that snake has better been devaminized! It better be!
And then
they try to put him on the gurney, and then they're just
and
trying
he
to...
fell off!
He falls off! And then it's like, oh my god, he fell off the gurney! It just made it even more horrifying. And then you have Jake in the ring, and he's laughing!
As great as Jake was as a babyface, I mean, and his promo style, his psychology, one of the greatest heels in the history of the sport. Unbelievable.
And the promo he cuts to Gene at Survivor Series, Gene's like, you said that the snake had been devenomized. Cross my heart and hope to die.
Hope to die.
I love the trust me, Jake. He's just being like a jerk, but he's doing it in like the most condescending way possible.
By the way, Jake Roberts was in my top 25. He just missed my top 20. He had a sensational run from 1986 to 1992 as first a heel, then a big-time face. I mean, he was either the third or fourth number three or four face in the company, and then being his top heel at the end with Savage, and then the match with Undertaker, which he would leave afterwards.
Yeah. I had Jake in the high 30s, by the way, so... And Jake was one guy that he didn't need a title. He was over, and he didn't...
Like Piper and Sergeant Slaughter before Slaughter left in 84, they didn't need a title. They were over without a title.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things that, in today's wrestling, it's like every guy has had a reign with, like, one title. Some people, they don't need a belt. They can get over on their own. They don't need a gazillion intercontinental title reigns. They have their feud culminate on Saturday night's main event, which leads to Jake and Undertaker having their program when Jake tries to hit Elizabeth with a chair. WrestleMania, it's the title match with Flair, which is another amazing program with the she was mine before she was yours angle.
Yeah, well, I dated her before. Yeah, they showed the pictures of her and him at a beach and at a resort, at a restaurant, and he promised more pictures after the match, which were never revealed. I mean, but that program came to a halt because Elizabeth filed for divorce soon after WrestleMania.
So after that, we go to SummerSlam, and then Warrior and the rematch they have a great match, a great title
match. Great match, yes. Yeah.
And then, oh, the title match, I would have forgotten to mention this, is the angle with Flair, and they have another great angle where they have teased that one of them bought Flair services for the match. And then it turns out none of them bought the Flair services.
Right.
It was just Flair doing it for the lulls, just to mess with them. And then that,
now Elizabeth leaves Macho Man for one of Hogan's friends.
Which one was that?
Now, Elizabeth in real life, after WrestleMania, soon after WrestleMania, after Savage beats Flair, Elizabeth files for divorce, and we find out that Hulk Hogan and his wife Linda had hooked her up with a doctor friend of hers. That she started seeing and that she left Macho Man for.
So that kind of explains the bad blood the two would have over the years.
Yep, from then on. Yeah, from then on. Yeah.
So then Savage loses the belt back to Flair with, I think, isn't it because...
Razor Ramon.
Yes, Razor interferes with that. But I think, they had to do the match twice because the first time they did it, it was so bad that Vince ordered them to do it.
Oh, McMahon was like, do it over! Go back out there and do it again!
That had to have been weird if you were sitting in the crowd.
I'm like, we just saw this match. What's going on here?
So, I guess this is when the transition sort of begins with him as announcer. But before we get to that, I would have been missed to mention Survivor Series 92 when it was going to be Savage and Warrior against Flair and Ramon, but Warrior leaves the company. And then they have to get Mr. Perfect into that match.
Yeah, Mr. Perfect to his face.
Which is the last great program that ever came out of primetime wrestling basically.
The first great match on Raw, the Loser League WWF match between Perfect and Flair.
Yes. So Savage is now an announcer. This is when the transition begins. I'm trying to think. He's not on Mania. He's not on SummerSlam. He's in at Survivor Series with Razor Ramon's team to replace Mr. Perfect. And then that's when he has the feud with Crush, which is...
He had a great match. Was it on Raw against Yokozuna for the title?
That was on a 94 Raw, February 94 Raw.
And then was a Royal Rumble where Yokozuna won, where he eliminated Savage. Savage hit him with an elbow off the top rope and tried to cover Yokozuna. Yokozuna pushes him over, throws him over the top rope.
With his body fat, just propels him over the top rope.
Yeah, propels him! And propels him 20 feet.
Only Randy Savage would make that believable, because that just seems like the dumbest thing ever.
But it was stupid for him to go for cover after hitting him. First of all, why are you going on a 600-pound man? Why are you hitting him with an elbow smash? He's on the ground. You can't move him.
Maybe they thought the match would be over if he just laid on. I don't know.
Yeah, he had the feud with Crush, which was a horrible feud. I mean, they try to push Crush as both a babyface and a heel, and it didn't work. It didn't work.
No.
Bryan Adams was just bad.
Then I think there's the match with Yokozuna on that one Raw, where he's trying to win the title before WrestleMania 10, and he doesn't.
A very good match. That was the last great match he had in the WWE.
Then he has the match with Crush, and then at Mania 10, which is the dumbest match. Where it's like that period where there's no hardcore doesn't exist, so there's this weird thing where you have to pin a guy, but you have 60 seconds to get back in the ring. It's the dumbest
shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And the one funny part that I love about that is when Savage just ties Crush's leg, and he wins the match. I would say that's the last Savage moment, and then that's it. He's on to WCW thereafter.
Well, McMahon told him that McMahon just wanted him to be announcer. McMahon didn't want to wrestle anymore because McMahon felt he was too old. And so Savage went and negotiated with WCW, and he left, and him and McMahon were never on good terms after that. Because he never came back to the WWF.
No.
Never after that.
And then...
And there was also rumors about him and Stephanie, but I'm not going to get into that.
No, and I don't think... I personally don't think those rumors are true, but that's just me. Okay, that will do it for part two. Part three will be coming up soon on Place to Be Nation. Until then, this is Greg Diener saying so long.
Don't count. Oh, there he goes.
He threw him out from the...